From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday in San Bernardino, in the midst of a holiday party for county employees, masked shooters dressed in tactical gear opened fire. 14 people were killed, 17 people wounded. The deadliest mass shooting since Sandy Hook. A lot at this point is unknown, but a police shootout left a man and woman connected to the assault dead. This hour on Point, a massacre in San Bernardino. You can join us on air or online. What was your first reaction when you heard about the shootings? Where did your mind take you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today with the latest on the ground in San Bernardino is Claudia Pescuda, a reporter at KNX 1070 News Radio, the CBS radio affiliate there. She was on the scene yesterday into the early morning hours. Claudia, how good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Hi, Jane.
So as we go to air, what's the latest there in San Bernardino?
Well, the investigation has been going on throughout the evening, and there are a lot of questions that are still unanswered. Among them, were there any accomplices? So we do know that there were the two people who were identified late last night as the shooters in this incident. Police identified them as 28-year-old Saif Farouk and 27-year-old Tashfeen Malik. We understand from a relative that the couple had been married for a couple of years. They had a six-month-old child who had apparently been left with a relative before the shooting took place. So also we know that ATF has been tracing the guns that were used in the attacks. So from what we know, it appears two of the guns were legally purchased, and then they have traced two of the guns to an unnamed person who has been identified by investigators, and two of them were linked to an unknown person. So we're hoping to find out more about all that, and also, most importantly, the possible motive for the shooting. Last night, the San Bernardino police chief did not want to speculate on that. He did say that they had not ruled out terrorism, but there were many unanswered questions about what led up to this and why anyone would want to do this.
Let's get to that point of motive. Here's some sound from Farhan Khan, who is married to the sister of the shooting suspect, Saeed Farouk. Asked at a news conference yesterday held by the Council on American Islamic Relations about the possible motive for these shootings.
I have no idea. I have no idea. Why would he do that? Why would he do something like this? I have absolutely no idea. I'm in shock myself.
In shock. I mean, what do we know about a possible motive? Work-related? Is this mental illness-related? Extreme ideology? What do you know?
Well, I mean, from everything we've heard, there haven't been any signs of, you know, Farouk being some sort of disgruntled worker. So we know he had worked for San Bernardino County for 5 years. He had been at this holiday party with coworkers earlier in the morning. Police say that he left under somewhat angry circumstances, but didn't really elaborate on that. And then a short while later, they say Farouk and Malik return heavily armed with firearms and explosive devices, and the shooting takes place. Mm-hmm. So it's unclear if there was something that was triggered at that party, if there was some sort of underlying issue that had been going on for a while. But by all accounts, you know, this man had been working for the county, had been, you know, somewhat liked by his coworkers. So, yeah, I mean, in other shootings, you know, we've heard of someone who's just been fired and they're angry and they're coming back mm-hmm. to take revenge. But there's nothing like that here.
Here's the San Bernardino police chief, Jared Burguan, at a news conference yesterday saying the suspects had to have planned their shooting rampage to some degree.
I don't think they just ran home, put on these types of tactical clothes, grabbed guns and came back on a spur of the moment thing.
So I'm reading here on the AP, Claudia, that authorities say the rifles used in yesterday's attacks were powerful enough to pierce the standard protective vest worn by police officers. Some types of ammunition used in those rifles can even plow through walls. I mean, these people were dressed in black masks, in tactical gear, armed with these very powerful weapons and pistols. I mean, they were ready for battle, as the chief said.
Yeah, and also they say that there were three explosive devices that were found at the Inland Regional Center where the shooting took place, and that was one of the reasons why it took so long for investigators to actually start processing that crime scene, because it wasn't until about, I think, 8 or 9 o'clock that they had finished dealing with those devices, making sure that they didn't pose a danger anymore. So I'm assuming we're going to know a lot more by tonight. Another location that was being searched was this home in Redlands. So they said they had multiple addresses that were linked to the suspect. And this home in Redlands was brought to the attention of authorities by a tipster. So when they showed up there about 4 hours after the shooting, they find the SUV that they'd been looking for. There's a pursuit that ends up back in San Bernardino. And so apparently the suspects run out of the SUV. There's a gun battle with police. And people who were in that area, witnesses to the shooting, tell me that it was like a war zone, that the shooting went on for several minutes. They heard several different types of firearms being used, and they also heard what sounded like some booms, and they couldn't really explain what that was. From what police say, there weren't explosive devices found at that scene. It could have been a flashbang grenade, something like that. We don't know about that. But just a running gun battle through this neighborhood in San Bernardino that ends with the two suspects dead. Also,
The third suspect, I was going to ask you about that, Claudia. What about that person?
Not a suspect. So a third person was detained at the scene. And really, from what police last said about this, it sounds like he probably is not linked. So they say that the law enforcement officials who were chasing the SUV only saw the two suspects flee from that vehicle. Other responding units then saw another man running from the scene when they arrived. So they detain him and take him in for questioning. But again, I'm guessing when they do their briefing this morning that we're going to hear that that person probably was not directly linked to the two suspects killed.
I hear you describe a horrific scene on the streets of San Bernardino after the shooting, and of course the terrible carnage in that building. Here's some sound from Olivia Navarro telling KABC TV that her daughter and some co-workers got away from the gunfire in the building.
They went into a room and locked the door. I told her, turn off the lights. And I haven't tried to call her because I didn't want the phone ringing.
This is Melinda Rivas in an interview with KNBC TV. She's a social worker who works at the Inland Regional Center, describing hearing people yelling down the hallway.
Heard another co-worker screaming, there's a shooting, there's a shooting, there's a shooting. Oh my God, she got shot.
And Mark Scrogans, whose daughter works in the building where the shootings took place, spoke with KABC TV yesterday.
They need to do something. This is crazy. There's just too many shootings. Too much bad stuff going on here. I mean, you hear about it, but this is insane.
Claudia Pescuda, reporter for KNX 1070 News Radio there in Los Angeles. Tell us more about these suspects. Saeed Farouk, born in Illinois. His parents were from Pakistan. What do we know about his background, and do we know if he indeed was religious?
That part I didn't really get a chance to look into. We do know that the couple had been married for 2 years, according to what the family said, and that they had this 6-month-old child, which is, is one of the things that, I think a lot of people were shocked by last night. The child was left with a relative, when this shooting was taking place. So Yeah, I'm guessing at this briefing that's going to take place in less than 2 hours, we will be finding out a lot more about that. And, you know, I think you mentioned earlier the Council on American Islamic Relations. They immediately came out and condemned these attacks. And as we heard from Farhan Khan, you know, just completely shocked. Like, you know, the family seemed very surprised by this, could not understand why this would happen.
We don't know a motive at all here. We need to stress that. One of the big questions, however, in San Bernardino is this terrorism? And as we go to air, what are authorities saying about that, Claudia?
They haven't ruled that out at this point. And they did make it clear that if they had any reason to believe that, you know, there were other people involved, there was some other threat to people in that area, that they would come out and make that public. So at this point, we haven't heard anything since. Obviously, that area is being swarmed by law enforcement from throughout the region and federal agents as well. So they are definitely looking into all possibilities. I think they want to keep an open mind about this, you know, rather than, you know, coming up with some early conjecturing. They're waiting to see how the cards play out.
Right. FBI, ATF, U.S. Marshals on the scene there in San Bernardino. In our last few seconds here, give us a sense about this community. What kind of community is San Bernardino? Affluent, middle class? I mean, what are we talking about here?
I would say middle class with some low income areas. It's about an hour's drive from downtown L.A. You know, this is in an area known as the Inland Empire. You know, just not the sort of community where you would expect something like this to happen. I mean, it's not really on a national or international radar. So, yeah, definitely a surprise to everyone. And one thing that people at the scene noted, you know, relative to people who work at that Inland Regional Center, this is a place where social workers and others who are dedicated helping the community work, the last place you would expect something like this to happen.
Claudia Piscuta, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the mass shooting in San Bernardino that left 14 people dead. You can join the conversation. Did the images of SWAT teams patrolling the residential neighborhood stop you in your tracks or not? Muslim listeners, do you already feel blamed, falsely connected to what happened there? Joining me now from Washington is Adam Lankford, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama. His research focuses on criminal behavior. He's author of the book, The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Adam Lankford, great to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Nice to speak with you.
And joining me in the studio is J.M. Berger. He's with the Brookings Institution's Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World, co-author of with Jessica Stern of ISIS, The State of Terror. J.M. Berger, so great to have you in here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's hear some sound as we speak to our guests here. This is an interview with CNN yesterday. Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations for the Greater Los Angeles Area condemning the shooting.
This is the time for us to express solidarity among all of us, Americans, in rejecting whatever the motives might have been. There is absolutely no justification for such horrendous behavior.
And at the White House yesterday, President Obama speaking with CBS News' Nora O'Donnell shortly after the shooting in San Bernardino.
We have a pattern now of mass shootings in this country that has no parallel anywhere else in the world. And there are some steps we could take not to eliminate every one of these mass shootings, but to improve the odds that they don't happen as frequently.
Adam Lankford, in terms of tracking a motive in this case, you've studied this for years, criminal justice professor there. Where do you start?
Well, you know, in this case, the offenders don't appear to have made it easy for us by leaving behind, you know, a manifesto, suicide notes, things like that. But one of the things I would say is, you know, sometimes people want to classify this as either terrorism or a mass shooting in terms of kind of the classic symptoms of mental illness or personal problems, crises. And that's a bit of a misnomer because in many of these cases, there are mass shootings that are also at least partially ideologically motivated. So in other words, it shouldn't be surprising that people who are struggling in their lives and sometimes have mental health problems are also attracted to radical ideologies. Now, if we look at the idea that maybe this has something to do with Islamic extremism, even in this country, we've seen 1993 attack at the CIA headquarters, 1997 Empire State Building attack, 2009 Fort Hood, 2015 just this summer, this Chattanooga military shooting. I've looked at all of those cases in depth, and in each case, we saw both a sympathy with radical Islamic extremism and significant psychological and personal problems in the attacker's life.
The president said we have a pattern now of mass shootings in this country. We should stress we don't know, again, the motive here. We don't know if this is linked to extremism at all. But J.M. Berger, President Obama, after the Planned Parenthood attack, said that these attacks are not normal. This is not normal, but sadly, it's becoming too normal. It's almost the new normal.
I think there's a real shift in the last couple of years, and it probably has to do with the pervasiveness of media. What we see in a lot of cases, you know, that's been discussed in the past is that there's a pattern of copycat activity. Somebody does something, acts out violently, and somebody else will try and emulate it. And when you have a 24/7 media, when you have 24/7 social media, that kind of influence can be much greater. And then on top of that, you have groups like ISIS and some domestic terrorist groups that are actively encouraging violence. And those people also have access to new platforms and new ways to sort of reach out and provoke people.
Well, though there does not appear to be any connection as at this moment to overseas terrorism, as you say, J.M., I mean, ISIS appears to be supporting and openly celebrating this mass shooting in San Bernardino. ISIS militants created the hashtag America Burning after the shooting when it appeared that there were three suspects. ISIS supporters tweeted, "Three lions made us proud. Let America know a new era. Hashtag California America Burning."
Well, ISIS supporters like to get out ahead of the curve on this stuff. So anytime something bad happens that they think they might be able to take credit for, they'll start talking about it. Sometimes they're more careful than other times. One thing that's a problem for us, I think, and I've written about this, is that we're increasingly allowing cases that are extremely marginal, that may be more like a traditional mass shooting with where mental illness is a greater factor than any interest in ISIS. And we're allowing ISIS to essentially pick and choose which of these attacks it will claim, and really giving them a very powerful propaganda tool.
A lot of listeners want to get in here. Let's get to some Catherine in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
I remember racing to pick up my son from elementary school right after Sandy Hook and thinking that that would be a turning point and that we would really tighten gun laws and I firmly believe that there's absolutely no reason why someone would need high-capacity magazines and assault weapons. And it doesn't – I think focusing on, you know, these terrorists celebrating this, it's like they don't have to incite anyone because we're doing it to ourselves. Like whether or not it's Islamic militants or not. Mm-hmm. It's a weekly occurrence. And I was talking to my son as now, you know, he's in middle school saying, you know, I'm just so disheartened and I just don't feel like it's going to change. If Sandy Hook wasn't providing that turning point, I don't know what will.
If it didn't change then, how will it now? Catherine, thank you so much. Let's go to Tony in Rock Island, Illinois. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
So I'm a bit conflicted because, you know, on the one hand, I think we definitely need to have stronger gun control laws and all of that. On the other hand, I think that we all as responsible citizens have a responsibility to, you know, take care of ourselves and be positioned to defend ourselves in such a situation. So, you know, the right to bear arms is a right that we have in this nation. And I think that if you are a responsible citizen, you should have the right to bear arms and be able to defend yourself. On the one hand, yes, you know, take cover and protect yourself. On the other hand, you should be in a position to respond to a shooter that's obviously inclined to hurt and kill a lot of people.
Tony, thank you for your perspective. I appreciate you calling. Adam Langford, jump back in here. It's striking to look at the list of these mass shootings in this country. 355, I read, mass shootings in the U.S. this year to date. San Bernardino, just 5 days after the attack on a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. A month earlier, 9 people killed at a community college in Oregon. In August, 8 people shot dead in Houston. In June, 9 people gunned down at a prayer meeting at a church in Charleston, South Carolina. And the list goes on, Adam.
Yeah, and I really empathize with your callers. And you can really, I think, feel and sense the fear that people have. But, you know, decisions made out of fear, you know, are often not the correct ones. Just to provide some context, I would point out that I did a study that looked at 171 countries and the number of public mass shooters in each country from 1966 to 2012, so more than 40 years. And by far the strongest statistically significant explanation for why some countries have more public mass shooters than others was firearms owned per capita. So even though people might think, well, we'll be safer if we have more firearms to protect ourselves, you know, the reality is there's no country in the world where that seems to be working.
Do you think, JM, this will move the conversations on guns in this country?
It's hard to see that it will. I agree with the caller that, you know, if Newtown didn't move the needle on this, it's hard to imagine what would. That said, I mean, you know, this is such a relentless barrage of incidents that it is possible we'll see some incremental changes. I mean, I think that similar to a lot of discussions we have about immigration, legal immigration, I think that, you know, a good first step would be to enforce the laws that we already have. And then, you know, it is possible that something else is needed, but I'm not sure that the American public will stand for it.
J.M. Berger, Adam Langford, stand by for a moment. I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Joining me from Memphis, Tennessee, is Yasir Qadhi, a Muslim scholar, a writer, and a Sunni cleric, professor of religious studies at Rhodes College, dean of academic affairs at the Al-Maghrib Institute, an Islamic education institution. Nice to have you, sir. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
What was your initial reaction to the shootings in San Bernardino?
The initial gut visceral reaction for all American Muslims when they hear of any such shooting is to make a prayer to God that, oh God, please make it not a Muslim, please not another Muslim, because we know that American Muslims actually suffer a double backlash. Firstly, we are the victims as well, and from what I understand, one of the victims that was shot 5 times was actually a Muslim lady. And secondly, we suffer from the backlash as well. When the broader public somehow assumes that the entire American Muslim population is complicit or deserves some extra scrutiny. And so our first reaction always is we don't want this to be affecting basically our faith and our people. And then after that, obviously, we feel for the people and the victims, and we pray that the broader public does have a conversation about gun violence, about the ease of access to these weapons of mass destruction, and that we come to our senses to have a safer society.
As we go to air, I need to say again, we don't have a lot of information about the background of this couple. Saeed Farooq, born in Illinois. We do know his parents are from Pakistan. His wife, a Pakistani-born immigrant who lived in Saudi Arabia before marrying Farooq. A lot of people are jumping to conclusions. We should not be. But how frustrating is it for you, Yasir, someone with a Muslim surname connected to such a tragedy?
Clearly, as I said, that this is one of the biggest problems that we face is that if some deranged mental gunman from any other ethnicity acts out his deranged fantasies, that person is considered to be a loner, considered to be basically a mental case, and the entire ethnicity or the religion is never complicit. However, when a Muslim loner gunman, when a Muslim mental patient, when a Muslim deranged shooter goes out and does a rampage, unfortunately, immediately we have talks of ISIS and jihad, and as of yet, as you correctly pointed out, Jane, there's not a single indication that this is somehow related to any type of broader ideological religious struggle. And my point is, even if it were, so what? That doesn't have anything to do with 99.9999% of American Muslims. Just like last week when there was, in all likelihood, a Christian shooter who targeted an abortion or a Planned Parenthood clinic, we didn't consider every single pro-life person to somehow be complicit in that shooting. And we understood that, look, this is a lone, deranged mental case. My simple request is that we should have the same standards when it comes to a person who might possibly be of a Muslim background. Blame the person, don't blame the ethnicity, don't blame the entire religion.
So just lastly here, Yasser, what should people know about the Muslim community that we're not hearing in this conversation?
The American Muslim community is a part and parcel of the broader American community. We are your doctors, your lawyers, your engineers. We are your co-workers and colleagues. We are your taxi drivers. We live here. This is our land. It's our land as much as it is everybody else's land. Yes, we have some crazy people, but so does every other group. And the fact that we have some crazies doesn't make all of us crazy. We all have all of our ethnicities and religions. We come together and we make this country a better place. And we need to learn from history that hysteria and fear-mongering is simply not the American way. I mean, there's talk of having internment camps brought back again. Have we not learned from what we did to the Japanese Americans in the 1940s that that's not the way forward? Mm-hmm. You can't stigmatize an entire ethnicity or religion or group. That's just simply unethical, and frankly, it's un-American.
Yasser Qadhi, professor of religious studies at Rhodes College, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here's an interview this morning from NPR's Steve Inskeep. This is Hussein Ayous, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations for the greater L.A. area. He said there are people who exploit events like yesterday's shooting in order to, quote, promote hatred and bigotry among Islam and against Muslims.
These things, unfortunately, these tragic events seem to be happening frequently around the country and around the world, whether, again, Colorado Springs, Muslims or the rest of the country did not point the finger at all white people or all Christians because of the crime of one individual. Mm-hmm. But it seems the same courtesy, the same respect is not always afforded to Muslims.
Jay Amberger, respond to what you've just heard.
So I think there is a serious issue here that both of these speakers are identifying, and that really is that our assumptions come from a different place. So when the shooter's a white male, the assumption is that he's a loner, and then maybe we work our way up to an understanding of the person as a terrorist. When the shooter is a Muslim, media will frequently assume it's a terrorist and then maybe work their way back to it being a loner. And, you know, this is I feel like I've seen movement on this over the last couple of years, especially in the wake of the Charleston church shootings, for instance. Earlier this year, you know, that people are coming to understand that terrorism is not just a Muslim issue, but, you know, there's a pretty clear bias in how media comes about it and how people talk about it. And there's a bias in our laws. Our laws on terrorism are focused on foreign terrorist organizations. There's not really a separate legal structure for domestic terrorism in the same way that there is for foreign terrorism.
Let's go back to the phones. John in Richmond, Virginia. Actually, Richmond, Vermont. John, is that you? Welcome.
Yes, Jane. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
I think we're going about this backwards, and I'll be quick.
Okay.
We're looking at guns. We're looking at cultural pluralism. We're looking at religious extremism. We're looking at mental health issues. And we're taking those on all individually. What I believe we need to do is a comprehensive approach where we're proactively exploring, putting resources into all these areas. So when we can start preventing some of those issues, perhaps, and secondly, that we're able to filter the information we get through a comprehensive approach. Mm. Focusing on guns, you move it in one direction and the amoeba just shifts around it. It's a full court press. It's got to be everything, and that requires massive effort, massive collaboration, cooperation, both from individuals in society as well as our politicians.
John, thank you very much for the call. Adam Lankford, jump in here before the break. A comprehensive approach to solve this very complex problem.
I don't think anyone can argue that there's a single cause of these incidents or that a comprehensive approach would be bad. I will say, though, that, you know, again, when I modeled this and looked at other countries, there are countries with more mental illness, for example, more suicides than us that don't have this problem. So, you know, it is reasonable to try to pinpoint what makes us different, and firearms are a major factor, although maybe not the only factor as far as that goes.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the shooting in San Bernardino, and you can join us. What's the right response from the nation on this? What do you make of ISIS praising the shootings? Great panel today. Adam Lankford, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, and J.M. Berger, terrorism and extremism expert. He's with me in the studio. Here's some sound speaking yesterday at the White House. Actually, this is this morning. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said that violence like the shooting in San Bernardino yesterday absolutely has no place in this country.
This is not what we stand for. This is not what we do. This is not what we work for. It's not what we live for. It's antithetical to our values.
After the shooting in Colorado Springs on Friday, President Obama said the drumbeat of mass shootings in this country is, quote, not normal. Enough is enough, he says.
We talked about this after Columbine and Blacksburg, after Tucson, after Newtown, after Aurora, after Charleston. It cannot be this easy for somebody who wants to inflict harm on other people to get his or her hands on a gun.
J.M. Berger, define terrorism for us today as we speak about this new mass shooting. Define it as a problem in this country.
Well, there's a real lack of consensus about exactly what terrorism is, and that fuels a lot of the problems we have in talking about this. For me, terrorism is an act of violence by a non-state actor against a symbolic target. So it's not meant to accomplish a military goal, but it's meant to move the political dialogue in the target country. And under that definition, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in this country that should probably be considered terrorism and it isn't. And I'll just pick one example. We don't really have any good data on hate crimes. So if a white guy kills his black neighbor, that is not clearly documented, whether it's a hate crime, whether it's ideological, whether it's the guy's simply what I call pedestrian racist, meaning he doesn't have a big advanced belief system supporting what he's doing. Whether it's a situational thing, whether they had a personal beef between them. And so a lot of these cases, you know, we're sort of looking at a big sea of violence and activity, and we don't know how much of it is really ideological and how much of it might fall under the definition of terrorism. Mm.
There's also the politicization of some of these events, that it is becoming a problem.
Yeah, well, I think the last couple of months have seen a real darkening of the political rhetoric, particularly in the Republican primary season. I think that there's some scary stuff being said. I mean, we have people talking about Muslim databases and stuff that really is kind of like unthinkable to American values. And there's an audience for this that is increasingly agitated. And so a lot of people who are off on the fringes of political discourse who we would consider extremists, domestic extremists, are seeing an opening for them to sort of enter mainstream political dialogue and they're responding to that.
Let's get a call in here from Stanton, Virginia. David is on the line. David, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
I'll preface my remark by saying that I'm a Virginia Tech graduate. I have two grandsons the same age as the Sandy Hook kids. I have a granddaughter the same age as the little girl at Tucson. Okay. Mm. This whole discussion, every time there's one of these shootings, we have certain statements that come out that the weapons were purchased legally. The police are searching for the motive. All these things are just you can just rewrite the story every time and just plug in the new numbers.
And okay. So, what's your take on this one, David?
My take is that the answer is guns.
Okay.
There's no way around it. We cannot control the production and distribution of mental health of mentally ill people. We can control the production and distribution and ownership of these types of weapons that have no other purpose than to kill people. They are not hunting rifles. They are not sporting rifles or guns. We need to ban the ownership, the production, the distribution of these semi-automatic rifles and handguns. We need to either repeal the Second Amendment or have Supreme Court justices who recognize the obsolescence of this archaic amendment.
All right, that's a long list, David, but I hear you. Thank you so much for calling. I'm seeing cross over the wires here. Senate Democrats will try to force gun violence votes on GOP's Obamacare repeal. Harry Reid saying on Twitter here, we're going to force the Senate to vote today on amendments to do something to stop gun violence. Adam Lankford, speak about this this guns piece and how you see this conversation moving.
I certainly appreciate the passion of your caller. I think some of the things he said probably are not realistic, at least in the short term future. But I am still optimistic that some progress will be made. One of the comparisons, or things to think about that I would bring up, and maybe Dr. Berger has a thought on this as well, is we've seen a pretty impressive pattern by the FBI of having these sting operations where they catch people who are planning attacks, and particularly planning terrorist attacks. One of the common themes in those successful FBI stings that prevent violence before it happens is that those attackers are almost always trying to get explosive devices, and they're unable to build them themselves. So, you could think about how different would things be if people had to reach out for help and ended up talking to like an undercover cop or an FBI agent, if they had to reach out for help to get the weapons to commit mass shootings. That would really be fabulous. And if we could move even slightly in that direction, I think the FBI has shown that when people need help to get their weapons, the FBI does a great job of catching them.
There's an interesting op-ed in the New York Times today, which cites the latest statistics on weapon sales. It says holiday shoppers set a record for Black Friday gun sales last week. The FBI processed more than 185,000 firearm background checks, the most ever in a single day, even more than gun purchases after the Newtown school massacre. Dr. Berger, could this finally force Congress to look at guns again, or where there'll be, movement in this conversation no matter how many times we have these mass killings in the news?
Well, just Mr. Berger. it's hard to see anything more than an incremental change ahead. As Dr. Lankford pointed out on the sting operations, that has been a tactic that has been used to divert potentially dangerous people from carrying out attacks. At the same time, it's pretty controversial. If we throw up obstacles to getting an assault rifle, to buying massive amounts of ammunition in one time, yes, that would create more opportunities for law enforcement intervention. But the question is, in the case of the terrorism stings, as well as in the case of what you would do in this instance, is, how many people are likely to actually go through with what they are planning if they didn't have the help of an FBI informant pretending to be a member of Al-Qaeda?
Let's go to James in Fayetteville, Arkansas. James, I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
How are you all today?
Hello. Go ahead.
Okay, there's two points to this, and it comes with a little bit of background. All right, as we've seen with the Paris attacks, when you take away the firearms from law-abiding everyday citizens, we become walking, talking targets. And unfortunately, the way I see it is whenever you start removing our rights and taking away our privileges of being able to own and possess, we become slaves. And unfortunately, I would much rather be a free man that can protect myself and take care of my own well-being than be a slave and only be waiting for someone else to show up when that help may never come.
James, thank you. Thank you very much for your thoughts. Let's go to Matthew in Norman, Oklahoma. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
The previous caller just mentioned about guns and everything like that. I think that's very intuitive to think about issues like this in that way. And I think it's only human nature to want to categorize things in such ways. But I think that if we're going to look at things like mass shootings, you have to look at it responsibly. So you have to look at causalities and, you know, like what causes it. And I think it's more the social and like cultural divides that are being created by different groups, such as, you know, politicians and the different groups that use these situations to for their own benefit and to just, you know, broaden the harden the divide between different groups of people, just like the race issues that are going on would be the same issue.
Matthew, thank you. It brings up an interesting point, J.M. Berger, that we talked about in the break about a shifting mood in this country, specifically as it relates to this. Would you tell us about that?
I think something that I've sort of learned from watching extremism online and watching ISIS in particular is that, you know, social media is really allowing for a kind of dramatic social reordering of society, not just here but around the country. ISIS is successful not because it wins a tremendous number of recruits, but because it can hunt among 300 million people on social media to find the 10,000 who will act on its behalf. And so what we're seeing is these kind of super empowered minorities are able to really change political dialogue all over the world. And, you know, we saw this in the Arab Spring as well. And where the Arab Spring failed was in the follow through, was in the organization to support what came after. I think that, you know, other extremist groups are learning from ISIS. They're looking at this. They're finding ways to exploit it. And just organically, the flow of conversation on social media lends itself to angry voices, lends itself to extremist groups. Extremist groups have not had access to mainstream media for many years. So when you have this kind of private media that you can carry in your pocket, it's like a pressure valve being released. They're able to flood into that and to organize and find each other in ways they never could before.
Mm-hmm. Adam Lankford, there's an interesting piece of this as well, that we're seeing more women involved in these shootings. Here, the wife of Saeed Farouk, named Tashfeen Malik, 27 years old. You know, whether it was a suicide bomber in Paris or this husband and wife team in San Bernardino, it's not just angry men anymore, Adam.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, when the news came out of multiple attackers yesterday, I think most people assumed that, you know, we're talking about multiple men. And that assumption clearly would have been wrong now. You know, I've also seen, you know, as you pointed out, to make that kind of comparison across borders, I've seen multiple examples of a husband and a wife or a man and a woman in a relationship who committed suicide attacks in the Middle East, either together that same day or sequentially, one after another. So I've also seen a case, and it was a foiled mass shooting in this country where a man and a woman were planning it together. And fortunately, you know, the police broke down their door and arrested them before anything happened. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, when we talk about dual attackers, male-female or male-male, sometimes there are kind of warped power dynamics there where one is really the leader and the other kind of goes along with it. But in other cases, they seem to be joint attackers. And that was one of the findings from the Boston bombers, where it wasn't older brother leading younger brother. It seemed like both brothers were, in some sense, equal participants.
Let's go to Caleb here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Caleb, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Hi. I just wanted to make a distinction with the lone slayer, the lone crazy gunman, and what's increasingly become terrorism, whether you know, Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, but in America. I think what scares people and where the difference does lie between the two is that the new spreading terrorist attacks in America, it feels to people like it's a movement, and it's political, and it's being inspired from abroad and perpetrated against innocents here. And whether it's from an Islamic feeling of disrespect over Palestine or generations of decline economically in the Middle East, a hatred for whatever it is, people are afraid that this Islamic movement is a movement, and it's being called up from some deep, you know, zeitgeist well, and people are responding to it, and that's very concerning.
Caleb, thank you. We're short on time here, but I want to get J.M. Berger in here. Again, I want to stress there's no motive in this case. We do not know what happened in the minds of these killers. But with that in mind, respond to Caleb, the caller.
Well, I think that, you know, there's in some cases, there's a certain element of sort of selection bias here. So what we see on television is always the most violent, the most dramatic, the most frightening story. That said, ISIS has been very successful at mobilizing people, small numbers of people who, thanks to practice and modern technology, can do a lot of damage even if it's just one, two, or even, you know, four or five people carrying out an attack. So, you know, the problem – there are a couple of problems that sort of attend to this. I mean, one is that this country is overwhelmingly not Muslim, and so – when we see racist violence, for instance, that is more familiar to us and less discombobulating, you know, whereas when we see this jihadist violence, to most people, it feels more foreign and it feels, you know, like an intrusion and something that's moving in here. I mean, one thing that I'm interested in as a point of study going forward and is understanding how extremist groups are like each other when you strip away the ideology and understanding – you know, what are the commonalities here? Can we understand these groups in a way that doesn't privilege one particular kind of ideology as being the most terrifying or scary over the other?
And beyond that, Adam Langford, I'll give you the last word. You know, the possibility that these atrocities, with gun control aside, you know, are beyond the power of government and politicians to stop, Adam.
Sure. So, you know, ultimately – anytime, you know, in this country or somewhere else, we see random, innocent, unarmed people being killed, people are going to be terrified by it. You know, and really, regardless of what the ethnicity of yesterday's shooters were, people are scared of mass shootings, they're scared of terrorism, and you just sense a lot of fear in the country right now.
Adam Langford, professor of criminal justice at the University of Alabama, author of The Myth of Martyrdom. Thanks so much for being with us today, Adam. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
J.M. Berger, researcher and analyst looking at terrorism and extremism, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. J.M. Berger, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.